this discussion of what it means to be too late, whether it is, whether it is not. That's on YouTube. He's got a whole series of YouTube. That's Paul Beckwith. I'll have him on again. So I just want to thank you so much. We're out of time, and hopefully we'll be able to have you back on before too many months go by. Thank you, Professor Wadhams.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Okay. And that was, again, Professor Peter Wadhams, Professor of Ocean Physics and head of the Polar Ocean Physics Group at the University of Cambridge, UK. This is Paul Rowland with Wednesday Talk Radio. Thank you so much. Stay tuned.
For humanity and souls to society. One day you'll wake up in the present day. A million generations removed from expectations of a being who you really want to be. Skating away.
Good morning, it's 9 o'clock. You are tuned to KBOO Portland. And here's what's coming up for the rest of the morning. Right away, we're going to have Waterworld with host Kristen Yount. Today, we'll hear an update on the EPA Superfund site at the Willamette Harbor with Rose Longoria of the Yakima Nation's Fisheries and Dr. Peter DeFour of the consulting group Environmental Stewardship Concepts. At 10 o'clock, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. And at 10:15, Flashpoints features an extended report on the killings of at least 9 teachers in Mexico. Also an in-depth discussion with Roots Action founder Norman Solomon, a pledged delegate for Bernie Sanders. At 11 o'clock on the Recovery Zone, Stephanie Potter interviews Jennifer Jones and Jessica Applegate of the Eastside Air Coalition, Alma Velasquez of the Cully Air Action Team, and Sarah Clark of the South Portland Air Quality Group about the toxins in Portland's air. For your generous support, and you can become a member if you're not one easily by going to kboo.fm and clicking on donate. Stay tuned in just a moment for Waterworld.
Stay up late with Lanita Duke and Grassroot News on Wednesday, June 22nd from 10 p.m. until midnight, as we celebrate the music of Roberta Flack, as well as agitating for social change. Remember, stay up late with me, Wednesday, June 22nd, 10 p.m. until midnight on KBOO.
Diversity of time. Into sugar water.
This is Kristen Yount for Political Perspectives, and this is Waterworld. With me in the studio today, I have Rose Longoria from Yakima Nation Fisheries and Peter DeFour from Environmental Stewardship Concepts, and he is here in Portland from Richmond, Virginia, to explain to us what the proposed plan put out by the EPA for the Willamette Harbor Superfund site cleanup. Such a mouthful. The EPA, or I don't who granted the money for you to come out here and be our consultant?
Good morning, and thank you. The funds that support my work for the Willamette River Keeper and the Portland Harbor Community Advisory Group come from a grant from EPA, and that grant can go to a nonprofit, qualified nonprofit within the community that's affected by the Superfund cleanup. In that particular case, a number of years ago, the Willamette River Keeper applied to receive a technical assistance grant, and those are written into law, And so those are federal funds, and they're available to communities around the country, in New York on the Hudson River, in Massachusetts and Connecticut on the Housatonic River, down in South Coastal Georgia and the Plains. Anywhere there's a Superfund site, these grants can be made available.
Excellent. So you're here for that.
Yes.
And that's, you go all over the country doing that, no?
Yes, I do. I cited some of the places where I work right now, Massachusetts, New York, South Coastal Georgia, Seattle, our neighbor to the north, and a number of places in between. For a number of years, I worked for 6 years at a former military base. So the military is also included in Superfund site cleanups.
Oh, yeah. And Rose, I've had you on the show before, and maybe you want to just tell our listeners a little bit about what you've been up to.
Oh, sure. Thank you, Christine and KBOO, for asking myself as a representative from Yakima Nation Fisheries to be on this show today and talk a little bit about Yakima Nation's work at the Portland Harbor Superfund site. As we mentioned before, your first name is Rose, last name is Longoria. I work for Yakima Nation, which is a sovereign tribal government with treaty rights in vast areas of the Pacific Northwest, including the Willamette River. And these treaty rights are not only the right to take fish from all usual and accustomed places, but also the right for those fish to be clean, healthy, and safe to eat. And so we are highly engaged, Yakima Nation is highly engaged in sites like the Portland Harbor Superfund site, as well as other sites up and down the Columbia River that affect Yakima Nation's treaty reserved resources.
How many Superfund sites are in the immediate Yakima Nation area?
Well, you know, that's interesting. Yakima's done quite a bit of analysis of various federal and state hazardous waste sites, but we also are bracketed just Superfund sites in the belt up towards the north near Canada, Hanford, and Portland Harbor. So those three nations, reservation, our ceded lands, our homelands, and are impacting all are impacting usual and custom areas of the Yakima Nation. Within work on identifying all hazardous waste sites within about a half a mile of the Columbia River from the banks of the Columbia, 6 hazardous waste sites that some are treaty resources and some not so much, but we are going through and prioritizing all of those sites. And we've identified about 60 sites that really need Yakima's attention for ensuring that those sites get cleaned up and cleaned up appropriate of our resources.
And I just want to clarify, it sounded like Yakima Nation was the one who, the entity processed just for the Willamette Harbor.
Oh, for Portland Harbor. So back in the 1990s, Yakima Nation tribal leadership went back to Washington, D.C. and basically advocated for the Portland Harbor Superfund site to be listed as a national on the national priorities list. Okay. Yes.
So, but it just seemed like there wasn't a Superfund site there before, or there already was one listed when Yakima got involved?
No. So Oregon DEQ had been doing work on various sites, hazardous waste sites, up and down the Willamette. But it had become fairly evident that it was a larger issue that needed a higher level of attention. And federal muscle of EPA to come in and really get things kicked off. And that's what started about 16 years ago.
Wow.
Can I add something?
Yeah.
Rose makes a really important point that's often lost on the general public, and that is that while we're talking about a single Superfund site, which has to be investigated and it's only listed if it meets certain criteria, there are hundreds of other locations. She referred to up and down the river, all of these hazardous waste sites, some of which may be an old dump that the town had for years and years, decades, or it may be an old factory that has long since collapsed and gone to dust, but they've left a contaminated footprint. And one of the differences that Rose knows is that it depends upon how big the site is and whether or not the contamination has moved and continues to move off that site. And just because it has not yet moved does not mean it will not. So when you have hundreds along the river, you have a potential disaster waiting, and so they need attention. And that's common throughout the country. Back in Richmond, Virginia, on the James River, we looked at that question last year. How many different hazardous waste sites and other problems do we have, in addition to the fairly small number of Superfund sites? And the ones here are enormous.
Yes, yes. Huh. Is the James River the one that had the coal ash dump into it a couple of years ago?
No, we have not yet had a major coal ash dump. The earlier one was in Tennessee, on the Tennessee River. And then 2 years ago, there was one out of North Carolina in the Dan River. And the Dan River is the one that flows into Southern Virginia through Danville.
All right. Kind of swerve back onto topic now. So Peter has to leave soon. I want to kind of just get into it. For people who have been listening to this program and for paying attention, the Superfund CERCLA process has been going on for 16 years. We're about halfway through the process. The proposed plan has come out last week. That set off a 60-day public comment period. Part of the criteria for the EPA Superfund process is that public comment and community input is asked for and desired. So now is the time to go to either the EPA's website, if you want to make a comment, that is, or you can go to www.cleanupportlandharbor.org. And there's a link there where you can go onto the website and make a comment about the Superfund site. And I have Peter here because I want to give a little bit more technical information for people to think about when thinking about the process of cleaning up the river. Cleaning up the river is going to mean pretty much like a construction site. I mean, it really does mean that there will be a lot of heavy machinery and things going on around the river, which seems scary, but when you think about construction sites and construction work, that's jobs, right? So we have a lot of people that could be gainfully employed with this process, and so the larger the site, the larger the site, the larger the more jobs, right? So anyway, that's just sort of logic, but there were a number of options, and the EPA came out with an option. And I don't want to confuse people by going into too much of the alphabet soup, but I want to talk about Plan G Plus, which was what the community had come up with. When I say community, I mean Portland Harbor Community Coalition, the Willamette Riverkeeper, Audubon Society, Yakima Nation, wanted a certain amount of material taken from the river. And conversely, the EPA has come forward with a plan that takes very little material out of the river. And that's the setup. So I'm just going to throw it over to you guys now.
Thank you very much. And Rose and I can go back and forth again the way we did last night at what I thought was a very good public forum.
Yeah.
I don't know who did the head count. I think there were probably about 120 people there.
That's what I counted. Yeah.
So the way in which this works, I think you've done a pretty good job about giving a thumbnail sketch. Last fall, EPA prepared a document that set out some of the alternatives that they were considering to use in cleaning up a contaminated river. And if your listeners think about what might be going on, or if you go look it up on the web, what's been done in other places to clean up contaminated rivers, you see that the options are not so numerous. You can take the material out, which is dredging, or you can cover it up, and that's referred to as capping, or EPA could do require a combination of those, so remove the surface layer and then put something down on top of that. And the putting something down on top could be just a layer of clean material, sand, rock, gravel, layers of those.
Charcoal.
And then there's the charcoal or other materials that do more than just cover, because the charcoal is intended to bind up the contaminants and prevent them from moving. That's activated carbon, same thing we use in our water filters or air filters or other material. So there are a fairly limited number of options. There are a few places around the country where they've tried a fairly new process, and it works on the shoreline. In Portland, a problem that we have is that a number of those industrial sites that have been there for a long time, many decades, maybe 100 years, have left a contamination footprint that has moved down into the ground, either because it was liquid that seeped down into the ground, or because the rainwater or the materials carried it down into the ground. As a result, you get a contamination in the groundwater, and that doesn't stay put. That groundwater doesn't just sit there and wait for something to happen. It moves. It moves as the groundwater behind it pushes it forward, and it's getting pushed into the river. And it's getting pushed across that interface, that connection that we would think of as a beach, but there are no beaches really there. So that's at the shoreline. So EPA and the Department of Environmental Quality have to face that problem as well. What do you do about that ongoing contamination? So one of the novel things that we see in the proposed plan that has been used a few times and only recently is you put down a layer of a mat material. So maybe it's one of these woven things that's got a lot of spaces in it and it's filled with activated carbon, or it's a mat that has some other material in it and its intent is to capture or filter or absorb the material that's coming out of that contaminated groundwater across that layer, that interface at the shoreline.
So like a Band-Aid, like a woven compress or...
That's it. Yeah. Huh. And they have a very short track record.
It seems like you would have to remove it periodically and, you know, check it, see if it's full or whatever.
Like, and recharge it.
Yeah. Right? It's not bad, you know. It's job security. I mean...
It might work. It might work. It's been used in a few places for a few years. However, dredging has been used for decades and decades. I mentioned last night that, in fact, the Army Corps of Engineers is empowered and directed by Congress to keep our waterways open. And that original 1898 was when they originally authorized keeping Portland Harbor open for navigation. And so they keep dredging it deeper.
Yeah.
But dredging, capping, and so they use a combination of those. How many acres are you going to dredge, and how much contamination will that dredging remove? And that goes to what we were talking about earlier, what mm-hmm. you mentioned. And last fall, EPA put together their first cut of what this plan was going to be, and they sent it to their National Remedy Review Board, because any Superfund cleanup that is greater than a certain amount of money, and I think it's $25 million. But 50
million,
50,
yes.
Anything more than $50 million, which everybody knows, we knew in the beginning this was going to exceed $50 million, has to be reviewed to make sure it's consistent and it's workable and make sure that EPA hasn't proposed a remedy that's way off the mark, or that isn't protective, or ignores something that they shouldn't have ignored. And so they sent that to the Remedy Review Board, and the tribes and the citizens saw that material and had a chance to, and did take opportunity to submit their own comments to the National Remedy Review Board, pointing out what they thought were the strengths and weaknesses and where it needed to be improved. And I know Yakima submitted comments last fall. And so we started with that point. And then we didn't see anything from EPA until June 8th. And on June 8th, they released their new feasibility study and the proposed cleanup plan. And that's when we saw some new things that took some of us aback. And they warned us that they were going to add an option to remove everything that was denoted as contaminated.
What they were calling bank-to-bank dredging.
Yes.
Alternative H, which actually, if you look at it, it's actually not bank-to-bank dredging.
It's not.
Which is a good thing. Which is a good thing. It's actually a good place to start looking at a potential actually preferred alternative.
Yes.
But, you know, before we go on, I know that for the KBOO listeners who have been tracking maybe this issue, or for Christine and other radio broadcasts that she has done and given some of the background information, just for some current listeners, just to give a little bit more of the bare bones background on this issue, as Kristen stated, you know, the site was listed in December of 2000. It's a 10-mile stretch of the lower Willamette River from about River Mile 2 to River Mile 11.8. We're looking at about 2,200 acres for the site. There are over 150 responsible parties. Those are the polluters that caused the contamination or took over land that had contamination and then became responsible for that contamination on the land. There are well over 80 contaminants. Actually, there's more than that, but there are, there's a lot. But there are some focused contaminants of concern, like PCBs, dioxins, furans, DDT, PAHs. It's important to understand that we're talking about contaminated sediment, contaminated surface water, contaminated groundwater, contaminated biota, and that they are contaminated with very persistent and bioaccumulative contaminants that will stay with us for not just hundreds, potentially thousands of years. And I just want to put out there that, unfortunately, you know, 100% of the site is toxic, and EPA's proposed plan basically dredges only 8% of the Superfund area. And in Yakima's review, our position is that this plan is grossly inadequate to protect human health and the environment, and especially inadequate to protect tribal members' health and way of life. And we are very concerned. We are asking the public to voice any concerns that they may have about the Willamette River. And we have joined with the Audubon, the Portland Harbor Community Advisory Group, the Willamette River Keepers, to let them know that there is a website. There is a website, and the website is cleanupportlandharbor.org. And we have put in a blanket statement, so if you just want to include your name on that and send that, it will go directly to EPA. There is also a section in there where you can put in your own direct comments. And it's just very important that EPA hear from the community as what the community would like that cleanup to provide. And Yakima has been very clear. We want clean, healthy fish that's safe to eat.
All right. So that website, again, is www.cleanupportlandharbor.org.
Yes.
And what you need to know is there. Also, if you prefer to show up in person with your fish suit on, I'm going to read off the times and dates that you can make a public comment. Anything, you know, any comment that you make at these meetings are supposed to be recorded and added to a public record and a public document. From what I understand, any comment that is made becomes part of the public record. And it's important when you make your comment to always have your name and your address and whatever information they ask for, or else it won't count. So these dates coming up are June 24th, 11:30 to 8 at the City of Portland building. That's 1120 Southwest 5th. June 29th from 11:30 to 8 at the Expo Center. That's 2060 North Marine Drive. July 11th, same time, 11:30 to 8 p.m. at University Place Conference Center. That's at 310 Southwest Lincoln Street. And July 20th, 11:30 to 8 at the Ambridge Center. That's 1333 Northeast Martin Luther King Boulevard. And those dates and times are also online. They're also on the KBOO.org website. I've put all this, all the links up for Dr. DeFer's website and also the Yakama Nation Fisheries website. So if you need to do any more homework, you can go and to those places and do that. So the proposed plan leaves a lot of material in place. It looks like, you know, compared to H, which was a almost bank-to-bank removal of material, it's like 33 million cubic yards of material. The plan that's proposed is 1,885,000 cubic yards. It's a dredge area of about 150 acres in a site that's over 2,000 acres. So when you leave things in place, and I just wanted to ask this to Peter, it's kind of a weird question, you know, rudimentary question, but what happens when you leave the sediment in place?
That's a great question, and we have some experience with leaving contaminated sediment in place, in some cases for decades, many decades. That decision actually predates or is pretty close to the same time as the Superfund law was originally passed. And so that's many decades ago. That's 4 decades ago. And in the James River, there was a chlorinated organic chemical. It was a pesticide that was left in place because they couldn't fathom the idea of cleaning up 30 miles of the James River. It was a pesticide called ketone. And we can still measure ketone in fish tissue today in the James River. And the James River normally has a very natural high rate of sedimentation, which buries things. And so you're going to gradually bury anything that's left in the surface sediment as the normal sediment covers it over. And that's hopefully going to be cleaner. It's not always cleaner. On the Hudson River, they made the decision that 200 miles of the Hudson River was beyond the scope of a cleanup, and that all they had to do was address the source problem, because they had two transformer facilities owned and operated by the General Electric Corporation on the upper Hudson. And if you get those under control, then the problem will gradually work itself out. That didn't happen either. And as EPA continued to review data every few years, they looked at things and they said, well, things aren't getting better on the Hudson River. And so we're going to go back and keep this Superfund process alive, keep it going. We're going to go back and look at some more data. And we're going to go back and see what we can do about that.
Okay.
And they discovered that the PCBs had accumulated behind dams. They sit there.
Oh, right.
In the case of PCBs, in the case of DDT, in the case of dioxins and furans, in the case of lead, arsenic, metals won't go away. They never break down. But these organic chemicals break down so slowly, and they're buried in even a small amount of sediment, that prevents the best degradation from occurring, which occurs in sunlight and open air.
Oh, yeah, because they're photodegrade. They don't biodegrade. You have to have light on them for them to go away.
Yeah.
So
they don't
go away. Leaving them in place, you know, makes it so that they cannot degrade, and whereas removing them and treating them makes it so they can. So even slow down. So what I saw was that I read a book, and it was talking about how leaving things in place in the Superfund process leaves the PRPs, the possible responsible parties, open to further litigation, especially if it might hurt their bottom line if they disclose, per the Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC, any hazardous waste cleanups in local, state, local, state, or federal waste cleanups, which I don't know if either of you know about this, but if you have a company and you are involved in a hazardous waste cleanup, you're supposed to report that to the Securities and Exchange Commission. So people, when they want to invest in your company or purchase your stock, if they know that you're involved with all these cleanups, you know, it's supposed to inform people. But from what I saw, business don't always do that. So I wanted to ask you if you knew anything about that.
I do know that not only corporations, but also local town governments, county governments, and in some cases state governments are very concerned about who's responsible for what's left behind, what's going to happen to it. Will the river eventually take those sediments that they think are going to be buried and wash them away? And we have to remember that we're talking about not 5 years down the road, not 10 years down the road, and not, it sounds like a much longer time period, not just the seven generations that will follow us, but 70 generations that will follow us will be facing that. What's going to happen to it? So will the corporation still be around to pay the bill? Will they post a bond to cover the future costs? Will the government be ready, willing, and able to handle any potential problems that come up? And we have to remember that some of the methods that are being considered have not been around for very long. And very long is described in the proposed plan, in perpetuity, which is forever.
So when they're doing the feasibility studies and they found material in the river that was placed there 100 years ago, they can tell that the origin of that material is gone, has been long gone for decades. So it's not something that is being introduced into the river all the time. So they already have the information that these things were placed 100 years ago from that particular industry. I don't know exactly what it is. The origin stopped decades ago. So the information is there that the natural recovery will not occur because it's still there. So, and even just in the small amount of time, you know, relatively 16 years, that people have been looking at the river and analyzing it and the sediments, even in the last decade, like, things have not changed. So I think what I'm trying to say is their natural recovery isn't going to happen, right? It's like it's a misnomer.
It is. It is. Natural recovery occurs and is effective only in those cases where the chemical contaminant is going to break down. If you just cover up lead, it's still going to be there at the bottom of the river. Maybe the sediment layer will get a little bit deeper. But one of the processes that occurs is that when you get clean sediments on top of these contaminated sediments, then the animals that normally are supposed to live there, the worms, the small crustaceans, you know, shrimp-like animals, the insect larvae, clams, snails, all of those begin to inhabit that sediment, whether it's sand or mud. There's always something that's supposed to live there.
Right.
That's the way life is on the planet. And as they start to live there, they're going to dig down to the normal depth where they live. That's their business. That's what they do. And when they reach that layer that's contaminated, they are going to be a vector for bringing that contamination back to the surface, which is why we see on the James River that we still have keep-on contamination in the fish and in clams, even though
it's buried.
Yes, it's buried under quite a layer of sediment, and they stopped putting it in the river 40 years ago. So we're going to have that problem here. The dioxin that contaminated Agent Orange that was manufactured and used in Vietnam, in several places around the country, is still a contaminant in sediments at the bottom of several rivers. One of them is up in Michigan, Dow Chemical Corporation. Another one is over in Newark, New Jersey, on the Passaic River. And that was, I don't remember who the original manufacturer was. The site is known as the Diamond Shamrock. So they're going to be there.
Okay.
So one thing to follow along with that is that You know, Yakima has been concerned about pollution not only in the Portland Harbor area, but also pollution that's being carried into the Columbia River from the lower Willamette River. And so these sediments don't just get buried. Some of the sediments actually get carried off. And the information is that a lot of the sediment is being carried off and carried into the Columbia River. And so we are seeing not only impacts and injury to resources in the lower Willamette River, but we're seeing those impacts into the Columbia River. And so it's important. Some of the pollution will be somewhat buried. It's not going away. But some of it is also being carried down into the Columbia. And that is very, very, very concerning, because that basically impacts all the migratory species that are traveling up the higher reaches of the Columbia and the Columbia River Basin.
And, you know, this is a question that's occurred on the Columbia, I know, in Washington, because I've had work up there as well, about when that pollution crosses the border. In some cases, it may be the border between Oregon and Washington, or it could be a tribal border. Mm-hmm. If it crosses in, that's somebody else's jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. And there are important legal questions there. And I don't know if Rose has had to face those, but I know that when I was doing some work up in Washington, they faced that problem. Decades ago, we had a problem with dioxin contamination across the borders of two eastern states. And that legal case came down very clearly. That's not allowed. And the state that whose waters are being contaminated has a legal right to sue the upriver state, say, you're contaminating our waters.
These issues are extremely complex, and not only are they state to state, or on reservation, off reservation, ceded land, all various types of land, but we're also talking about international impacts of contamination in the northern reaches of the Columbia River. There's Tec Cominco, which is in Canada, and it has created the Superfund site in the United States, Upper Washington, Lake Roosevelt. So it's contamination that was generated in Canada and has been washing into the United States and into the Columbia River, and one of the larger Superfund sites in the Northwest.
Whoa! So it looks like it sounds like we have a call. Is the caller there? Hey, Laura. Hey, it's Laura.
Yes. Hi. Good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for being here this morning. I wanted to bring up back to the contaminants in the river. I went to a meeting about 3 years ago where I heard, Peter, I heard you say that PCB is one of the most toxic contaminants in the river, do become airborne, and basically impact like a 5-mile radius, those of us who live near the river. And I never forgot about it, and I would bring it up continually. So last night when you said this again and that it was a glaring omission on the EPA's proposed cleanup plan, I was grateful, because I think we need to know that even if you don't swim in the river or eat from the river, if you live near the river, you're impacted by what is a really carcinogenic form of air pollution. And I'm grateful that you brought that up. And when I brought it up at the Linton Community Center a few months ago at a forum there, I was told that it was an alarmist view, and that wasn't the biggest thing that we should be concerned with. So thank you so much for bringing that up, and I hope everybody heard it. And if you wanted to comment on that, I'd be grateful. Thank you.
That's right. EPA, for a number of years, was investigating what happens to PCBs and when they're on the ground, when they're in sediment that's been exposed to air. Do they move into the air? Do they become volatile? And the reason they ask that question is because they are so stable. And normally, chemicals that are that stable and persistent and bioaccumulative do not become airborne. They don't become volatile. But as has been mentioned before, PCBs are a group of chemicals. It's not just one single compound. And some of them are heavier and some of them are lighter. And the lighter ones are the ones that can become volatile. several researchers around the world have been investigating this and trying to determine whether or not that means anything. And the things that they're looking at is whether or not the PCBs will move off of water, off of sediment that's been dredged, off of soil, off of sewage sludge. That's one of the sources of them as well. Will they become airborne? Do we inhale them? If we inhale them, do they stay in our bodies or do we breathe them out? And if we do keep them in our bodies, does it cause any harm? Are there any health effects? Because this is a different group of PCBs than the ones that are traditionally accumulating in fish and that we get from eating animals. Well, recent researchers have at Harvard University working in eastern Massachusetts at New Bedford Harbor and the State University of New York at Binghamton, Dr. David O. Carpenter recently published a paper indicating the answer to all those questions is yes. There are PCBs that become volatile. When they're in the air, we breathe them in, we absorb them, and there are health effects. And so he explains some clinical cases in which people were exposed to very high amounts, which is not the usual situation, but it demonstrates that the process occurs. So what happens? And then he went and looked at the people who live within the vicinity of the Upper Hudson River. The Upper Hudson River has a Superfund site, which is a contaminated by PCBs. It's in water. Well, would the PCBs come off the water? Would they wind up in the air and people get exposed to them? The people who live within the Upper Hudson River have a higher socioeconomic status, and they normally are expected to have better measures of health. Not so much. In fact, they have a higher risk for a number of diseases that are associated with PCB exposure. So he goes through this paper step by step, looks at research that was done in other parts of the country, other parts of the world, and really builds the case very effectively that yes, we have a problem with airborne PCBs at places like Portland, where we have a PCB contaminated site. And about the same time, a group of EPA researchers called upon investigations into what airborne PCBs will do. And their focus was on indoor air, because we know that paints and caulks and building materials often had PCBs, and some of them still do.
Huh. Wow.
Frighteningly.
So it's a, okay.
Yeah, so I'm going to have to.
Yeah, Peter has to go, and I just wanted to let our listeners know. We are here. This is Waterworld. My name is Kristen Younes. I'm here with Peter Defer, and he is a consultant who is granted to community, the Portland Harbor Community Coalition, which includes a lot of groups, and he is here to sort of break down the proposed plan that was put out by the EPA last week, and also Rose Longaria, who is from the Yakima Nation Fisheries, and she's here to talk about the impact that the polluted river has on the Yakima people and all of us, actually. And so I want to say farewell to Peter.
Thank you so much
for coming. And his information is on the KBOO website. And are you going to be around in Portland for?
I'm going to be around the rest of the day. I leave around noon tomorrow.
Okay.
And then I will be back.
You'll be back. All right, cool.
I'll be back. And I'm always reachable by email or on the website. Either contact the Riverkeeper or the Portland Harbor Community Advisory Group, the CAG.
Okay. Thank you. So as we say goodbye to Peter, I want to ask people if they have questions for Rose. You could call in. It's 503-231-8187. I want to just let you know that if you want to make a public comment about the EPA's proposed plan, which Rose says is vastly inadequate. June 24th at the City of Portland building downtown at 1120 Southwest 5th from 1130 to 8. June 29th, 1130 to 8 at the Expo Center, 2060 North Marine Drive. July 11th, 11:30 to 8, University Place Conference Center at 310 Southwest Lincoln, and July 20th, 11:30 to 8, at the Ambridge Center, that's 1333 Northeast Martin Luther King Boulevard. And you can go online to cleanupportlandharbor.org and follow the link and make your own comment. And maybe you can talk about what kind of, there's a metric for how the EPA goes through these vast amounts of comments and decides what's relevant. Do you have any insight into that?
So EPA is going to be collecting comments over a 60-day period. There have been requests from various organizations, Willamette River Keeper, the CAG, the Audubon Society, and I believe others have asked for a lot longer comment period, because it's important to understand that this is a very, very complex issue. Portland Harbor is considered a mega Superfund site. And that what that means is basically there are several Superfund sites combined into one very, very large site. It's very complex. There's a lot of contaminants. There's many players. You have federal, state, tribal governments. You have over 150 PRPs and environmental groups, community members and politicians, and all of those individual, all of those different organizations or governments have different interests. But, you know, the comments are not going to just come from folks who are concerned about the river. There are also going to be comments that come from industry, and which will have the industry perspective and concerns, and often we'll hear their messaging of this is going to cost too much, and this is going to take too long, and this is going to cost jobs, and so forth and so on. And it's important that EPA hear the concerns of a broad-based constituent of the community, so that they're not just hearing, which I think that they have been hearing for a long time from industry and directly from industry and not from community members. But EPA has a responsibility to look at each and every comment that is submitted. And whether those comments are technical in nature or simply I depend on the Willamette River and I want the Willamette River to be safe. I want to be able to eat fish from the Willamette that is clean and healthy and safe for me to eat. Any comment that is personal in nature, I think the numbers matter. EPA receiving vast number of comments from the community is going to be key in their analysis of what the community wants and is asking for.
Yeah, because there's precedence of the EPA, after the proposed plan comes out, that they modify it because they have public outcry or because the tribes say this isn't adequate. There is precedent for that? Or
there has been instances in which community input has modified the plan. I will say this. I'm a little disillusioned with the Portland Harbor process. It seems as though the primary driving force behind this are the concerns of industry and industry wanting EPA to produce something really quickly. Originally, when the process started, EPA estimated that it would take 2 years to develop and write their proposed cleanup plan. And because of pressures and because of the change in administration, there was a lot of push to make EPA deliver the proposed plan quickly so that it could be signed within this administration. Pressure from all different, from industry, from others. And EPA took a process that would normally take 2 years, or what they originally stated would take 2 years, and condense that into a 4 to 5 month period. And quite frankly, based on our initial review of the proposed plan from EPA, we see inadequacies, we see a lot of uncertainty, we see conclusions that are fundamentally not supported by the information in the plan. We have vast concerns about this proposed plan, but unfortunately, it doesn't seem as though the voice of reason has entered into this dialogue at Portland Harbor Superfund site, and this feels like a runaway freight train. And right now, looking in my crystal ball, it looks as though we are going to end up with a EPA cleanup plan that is not protective of human health and the environment, and that allows for institutional controls rather than actually dealing with the problem and removing the contamination. It's very unfortunate. And I would say that the only potential way of getting that freight train back on the tracks and slowed down is for the community to talk with their congressional representatives, talk with their city representatives, talk to submit comments to EPA, and even reach out to industry and encourage a better cleanup.
Yeah, that's sort of where I wanted to. I've been dying to do this for so long, but I'm going to quickly just say that today we're meeting here at the station the day after the very first public forum after the proposed plan was released last week. And on the very same day at OMSI, there was a presentation by the Human Access Project that was funded in part by the Port of Portland, which is a PRP. They are on the hook for paying for the removal of the sediment and the cleanup of the river. Also, that thing was put on by Northwest Natural. They put a lot of money into this movement to get people's bodies into the river and swim around in there. And I just want to point out that some of these PRPs, the people that are supposed to pay for this, are advocating for people to enter the river at this time when it is so important that people realize that the river is extremely unsafe. The Human Access Project has two documents on the website. One is a DEQ report, which is an upland report, I believe that the DEQ doesn't have much to say about water quality, and a very skimpy report by the Portland Health Authority, which pretty much says it's not untoxic, or say, you know, sort of. I mean, if you talk to somebody, which I have, from the Portland Health Authority, and you ask them, is it toxic for people to swim in, the sciencey answer is no, but they wouldn't. And I don't know anybody that's put any sort of focus on whether or not they'd swim in the river and say yes, unless, of course, they are part of a possible responsible party. And I have a spreadsheet that you can easily download from the website with is 18 pages long, and it has 150 names on it. And these are the people, the entities that are responsible for paying for the cleanup of our river, and then they're putting hundreds of thousands of dollars into campaign to get people in the river, which I think is, you know, whatever I think doesn't matter, but that's up to you. So I'm just going to read a couple off. Some of these sound so unfamiliar, but Columbia Forge and Machine Works, Freightliner, Pamplin Group, that is the Ross Island and also the owner of the Portland Tribune. Kinder Morgan Bulk Terminals. Metro. Yeah, our regional government is a PRP. They are legally responsible to clean up the river. McCormick and Baxter, that's a creosoting company. NL Industries. Ross Island Sand and Gravel. Rusco Incorporated, Sulzer Pumps, Steelhammer Properties, Summit Properties, the Marine Group, Union Carbide Corporation, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, yes, on the hook to pay for this cleanup, the U.S. Bonneville Power Administration, the BPA is on this list, the U.S. Navy is on this list, the U.S. Coast Guard's on this list, So I take that information. I mean, if I guess what Rose said, if you want to just reiterate how, would it be something that you would do to put pressure on the industry, like a name I just read off? And would it help to ask these entities on their own to pay attention to what's going on and ask for a better plan?
You know, I think it depends on the industry itself. There have been a multitude of companies that have been engaged, and I think it depends on the own ethos of the company. But we definitely have some companies that have, and especially I would put like the city of Portland is a responsible party, but I think in a lot of instances they've been somewhat of a voice of reason, and we just hope that they continue and become much more aggressive in providing a little bit more reason to this cleanup. Port of Portland is engaged, and I think depending on their constituents will make, you know, they have a business side, but they also have a public relations side. And it depends on how they view those two different competing, potentially competing factors. But yes, putting pressure on industry directly, or, you know, if they know that there is a lot of community attention to this issue, it may sway how much pushback they give to EPA. But I also, you know, it's important to understand what we're facing here. And right now, EPA's proposed plan, as I've said before, is grossly inadequate for protection of human health and the environment. And it is not okay to leave 92% of the river toxic. That is not acceptable. Contaminated fish, not acceptable. Limitations to how the community can live with and enjoy the river, not acceptable. So it's going to be up to community members to, again, apply pressure to their political legislators, congressional representatives, city representatives, and most importantly, EPA.
All right. So elected and non-elected government officials there, list of those. I really want to thank Rose Longaria for being here. There's so much going on. It's like 16 years worth of feasibility statements and input, and so much of it is so well documented on the Portland Harbor Community Advisory Group website. That's the Portland Harbor Community Advisory Group's website, and I have that on our KBOO website. You can Google the Portland Harbor CAG, and they have a very extensive website, second only to the EPA's website, which is extensive and has many, many documents for you to peruse there. Thank you again for being here. That's pretty much all the time we have, I think. I'm Kristen Yount. This is Water Worlds for Political Perspectives on KBOO Radio.
City of time turns her voice into sugar water.
It's 9:59. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. Coming right up, it's Chris Andre hosting Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. And then at 10:15, Flashpoints features an extended report on the killings of at least 9 teachers in Mexico. Also, an in-depth discussion with Roots Action founder Norman Solomon. He's also a pledged delegate for Bernie Sanders. At 11 o'clock, we've got the Recovery Zone today. Stephanie Potter interviews Jennifer Jones and Jessica Applegate of the Eastside Air Coalition, also Alma Velasquez of the Cully Air Action Team, and Sarah Clark of the South Portland Air Quality Group about the toxins in Portland's air. Thanks for tuning in to CABE today. In just a moment, we'll get right to Air Cascadia.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Green Day's American Idiot, produced by Triangle Productions. Don't wanna be an American idiot. The 2-time Tony Award-winning hit follows Johnny, Toonie, and Will as they flee the constraints of their hometown for the thrills of the city life in this energy-fueled rock opera. That's American Idiot, June 9th through July 2nd at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. One nation controlled by the media. Information age of hysteria is going out to idiot America.